Welcome to the Devin Nunes Podcast, breaking through the political noise, separating fact from fiction. From the San Joaquin Valley, the breadbasket of the solar system, here is your host, Devin Nunes.
Welcome back to the Devin Nunes Podcast. We are pleased to have with us this week, retired Navy Captain Jerry Hendricks, not to be confused with Jimi Hendricks, no relation. But I think one of the, at least for the United States and probably across the entire globe, one of the premier naval experts. And Jerry, welcome back. And I wanted to take some time and just talk a little bit about the history of the Navy. I don't want to go all the way back to the Revolutionary War and Civil War, which I know you can do and do well. But why don't I want to start in World War II, because it was an interesting time when we had at that time had battleships, and we were just getting into aircraft carriers, and there was a fight internally in the Navy pre-World War II. And really what happened is we weren't prepared at the time for World War II. And I'd like maybe for you to walk us through the history of that disagreement within the U.S. Navy and then how it went into World War II from there. And I have a little bit of personal preference for the Navy during that time period because my grandfather served in World War II on a transport carrier in the South Pacific. So it always brings back good memories to talk about this era in time. But let's start first with the battleship versus the aircraft carrier.
So coming out of the late 1880s, you know, we had this natural progression of the line of battleships. So the three-deckers and the British, the sailing ships, became naturally, as we got steel and steam, became battleships. And they still acted in a line. They would sail in steaming formation, one behind each other. But it was sort of conceptually that was the way navies had always sailed. And so when we got steam and steel and big steel guns, we continued to operate that way. And in World War I, we still operated with a battleship-centric thought about strategy. But in the 1920s and 1930s, what we call the interwar period, we began to innovate. So aircraft carriers were created actually by the British in World War I. 1914 is the first aircraft carrier that we see operated, the idea of using aircraft as spotters for the battleship. But once you had aircraft flying from these ships, suddenly you began to think about, well, can I use them for something else? Could I use them to attack the other enemy fleet? And so there was this natural and rather rapid progression of the idea of both aircraft carriers as well as that other nasty thing from World War I, which was the submarine. So these things are operating in tangential. Up until World War II, navies existed to assure sea control of the seas, so that you could have access to the sea lines of communication for your troops and your trade. But once we get into World War II, suddenly aircraft carriers, and I must also say, marine amphibious assault units began to give navies the ability to project power ashore.
Project forces
ashore, and hence aid in the land battle, the ultimate strategic thing of conquering land. So there was this debate going on in the United States Navy. The battleship admirals were still very much in control of the U.S. Navy, but the aircraft carrier aviators were coming up. They were younger. They were junior. They didn't have as much political influence. But there was this debate as to who would have preeminence. Fortunately or unfortunately, tragically, the Japanese settled that for us because the battleship fleet that was anchored at Pearl Harbor essentially was destroyed on December 7th. And the three aircraft carriers that were in the Pacific were actually out to sea that day. So they weren't present in Pearl Harbor. And had they been, they would have been the chief target of the Japanese, who had come to an understanding that it really was the aircraft carrier that mattered. So, but they weren't there.
And that was by luck.
That was by luck.
As I recall.
Yeah. Halsey was supposed to have the Enterprise and his task force in, but weather had delayed him coming across. So he was still 200 miles from Pearl Harbor on the morning of December 7th. And so he comes in literally later that evening and, of course, was greatly angered by what he saw. But we had three aircraft carriers, and we immediately began to use them independent of battleships because we had no battleships. And began to try and do relief of Wake Island. And then ultimately, just a few months later, at the Battle of Coral Sea, we had the first great naval battle in the history of the world where the opposing fleets never saw each other. So the Japanese carriers launched against our aircraft carriers. We had in-air fights between airplanes, and ultimately the airplanes attacked each other's ships. The Japanese lost a carrier. We lost a carrier. USS Lexington went down. It was a tactical defeat in that.
And so I'm big into geography and maps on my podcast. So let's bring the listener who doesn't know where the Coral Sea is.
Yeah.
What's the relative location on the globe?
Think of it
How
as
would you find it?
North, northeast of Australia and, you know, south, southwest of Hawaii. So Hawaii is in the middle of the Pacific, which, by the way, very few people understand how big the Pacific is.
It's a long way from Hawaii to Australia.
Like you could fit the moon into the Pacific. You know, it's that big. And so it was a long way from Pearl Harbor, but the Japanese were expanding outward and they were threatening our allies in Australia and New Zealand. And the Battle of Coral Sea stops that. So although it's a tactical defeat for us in that we lost a bigger carrier than they did, it was a strategic victory in that we stopped the Japanese advance and expansion.
And what was the date on that?
So that's May 4th through May 8th of 1942 is the Battle of Coral Sea.
So we get hit in Pearl Harbor. Now, already at that time, we're boosting production of these – of different types of vessels, right? Mm-hmm. They're building transport carriers. But when do we really – is the ramp up already – has it already happened then when we're already producing the tonnage and the – I don't know if I'm using the correct naval term. But what kind of ships are we producing kind of pre-Pearl Harbor during that period?
So
post Pearl Harbor,
and
then how does it continue kind of through World War II?
So this is important because it's kind of important to some legislation or resolution. It's in the House. The Two Ocean Navy Act had been passed in 1938 and then 1939, and that began the ramp up of our Navy. But the problem is it takes a long time to spin up the defense industrial base, and so we were just in 1941 beginning to see ships enter the Navy that were authorized and paid for in the late 1930s. And so this is a lesson to us today that when you think about the defense industrial base today, that it takes a while. It's not instantaneous, spend the money and get a ship.
Right.
And so they were just beginning to see everything. So they were building destroyers, cruisers, and battleships, as well as aircraft carriers with this money, because they weren't sure what was going to work. After Pearl Harbor, we sort of reallocated and began refocusing our resources on building a lot of aircraft carriers and not so many battleships because we needed cruisers also to escort the aircraft carriers because the cruisers help with do air defense.
So when does the battleship finally come out of production then?
So it doesn't come out of production until after World War II. The last four battleships, the Iowa class, which actually saw service during my career in Desert Storm, we had four of those that were reauthorized by
Ronald. Those were built in World War during
They were built at the end of World War II, and two of them are still kept in active reserve that you could bring them back into the fleet even today, the last battleships in the world.
And they're essentially the challenges with them, they're big and slow, big targets.
That's right. Well, they're big, slow targets. And the idea of gunnery that can only go 25 miles no longer makes sense in this modern anti-access air denial environment where missiles can literally travel hundreds of miles. So that's sort of the challenge. World War II then, you know, we had the Battle of Midway. So after Coral Sea, just a month later, we're at the Battle of Midway. And Midway turns the tide. In 4 minutes of action at the Battle of Midway, three Japanese aircraft carriers are sunk in a four-minute segment of time. So it was four Japanese carriers versus three American carriers. And we got lucky because we had great intel. Again, the importance of intelligence. To have Joe Rochefort at the hypo station, which is the intel station at Pearl Harbor, identify that the Japanese are going to attack Midway. And so we put our ships in the optimal position, point luck, just north-northwest of the island of Midway. And so that when the Japanese came down from their home islands, we were there to intercept them and hit them when they weren't expecting it.
So they lost they lost three aircraft carriers and fled.
They ended up losing a fourth the next day. So they lost all of their mainline fleet carriers and most of their pilots, which was important. The United States
and the date is what?
That's June 4th through June 6th, 1942. So that's also
quickly.
It does. Mm-hmm. And that's the last battle, by the way, of the regular Navy. Because after that, not only is the great engine of democracy spinning up, and we're spitting out ships, but we're also commissioning reserve officers and new enlisted men, and we're rapidly swelling the Navy. So on June 4th at Battle Midway is the last day of the sort of the pre-World War II Navy holding the line until the reserves can come in.
So I want to finish up this segment because it's just been fascinating, but I want to talk just a little bit, if you could tell the story, because my grandfather was there, and so I only know his version, which I'm sure is, you know, is only from a guy who was on one of the transport carriers, but Typhoon Cobra and Halsey's Folly.
Oh.
And if you could kind of walk through, because that was one of the most devastating days in the history of the U.S. Navy, yep, even though not a shot was fired.
That's right. So we lost nearly 20 ships, destroyers and small boys. And it's one of these things where you start to, you know, our understanding of weather today, now in sort of the post-Sputnik era where we have satellites up and tells us, you know, when the clouds are coming and when the hurricane's building. We didn't have that then. I mean, if you think about Halsey's Folly and the typhoon building, and then the ships being caught on the wrong side of the typhoon, and Halsey not maneuvering them out of the way. It was one of those areas. Halsey was a brilliant, very aggressive commander of troops in battle, but he wasn't really sensitive to the environment around him. This was a common issue with him. And so he makes the mistake and doesn't maneuver the fleet away when the barometer is dropping precipitously and very quickly. And he actually leaves the fleet exposed to a typhoon. And we actually lose more ships to that single typhoon than we do in any other major battle of the war.
And aircraft.
And aircraft, exactly.
And sailors.
Yes.
Right? Over 1,000, 1,200?
Yes.
Something
yes.
like that?
It's pretty amazing. And so it's interesting because, you know, that's your grandfather's experience. My grandfather was a veteran of Normandy. And so, you know, a lot of people talk about Normandy with the airborne troopers and the gliders and that whole bit. But the Navy was essential for the Battle of Normandy because the Battle of Normandy actually lasts 28 days. And if a ship gets sunk on day one, it's not there to do its job on day two, day three, because it was a huge logistics line going across.
So what I'd like to do is have you – I want to have you back on to talk about – because we've talked about battleship versus aircraft carrier. We've talked about – I think a pretty good run of what happened in the Pacific. I'd like to have you back on, if you're willing, to talk about the Atlantic.
Okay. I look forward to it. Yep.
If people want to read Jerry Hendrix's articles that he writes periodically, you can read them at National Review or the National Interest. Just go to DuckDuckGo. Don't go to Google because they spy on you. And you can find it. Just type in his name, Jerry Hendrix. This is Devin Nunes, the Devin Nunes Podcast. We'll catch you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Devin Nunes Podcast. We invite you to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And remember, you can download this podcast on iTunes or at devinnunes.com.
Storm clouds been gathering so long, I don't know.
The darkness around us leaves no easy road.
We started wondering if every road dead ends our dreams.
It whips the dust up and rains pouring down.
Good people struggling in every hometown.
We've started wondering if we even matter at all. We'll take that hard road to happier days. Cause we've kept our American faith.
Not our first trial by fire like this.
It's nothing hard work and family can't fix.
We've got the power to save it all here in our hands. We'll take that hard road to happier days. Cause we kept our American faith. We the people free and strong fight.
compass, we're already half the way there. We'll take that hard road to happier days, 'cause we've kept our American faith.
Paid for by Devin Nunes Campaign Committee.